Welcome to Piano Inspires podcast, celebrating pianists, teachers, and innovators as they share their inspiring stories about the transformative power of music.
Hello, I'm Alejandro Kremaski. I'm professor of piano pedagogy at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm also director for research advancement at the Francis Clark Center for Keyboard Pedagogy. So today we have the pleasure of having with us Vanessa Cornett. Vanessa is the Director of Keyboard Studies and Professor of Piano and Piano Pedagogy at the University of St. Thomas in the beautiful city, in the beautiful twin cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul. She teaches piano and courses through the graduate program in music education, including elementary and intermediate piano pedagogy, keyboard literature, and music theory pedagogy. In the undergraduate Aquinas Scholars Honors Program, she co-teaches seminars on music and the mind, the science of musical experience, music and meditation, pathways to transformative learning, and art and music as contemplative experiences and mindfulness in context. She is really one of the experts in this field within the piano pedagogy field. So I'm really, really happy to have you with us to find a little more about your background, your work, and so forth. She holds professional certification in sports psychology, occupational ergonomics, meditation instruction, and hypnotherapy. And she's also been trained in trauma-sensitive mindfulness practices, and she has a long list of publications, many wonderful articles and papers in several different magazines, also a book, The Mindful Musician, which was published recently by Oxford University Press, right?
That's right.
Okay, wonderful. So I was thinking maybe we can start a little bit about your, the history of your life as a pianist. So if you can tell us how you got started and you know, what attracted you to music and a little bit about your background there.
Sure, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here and just talk about things that we enjoy talking about. So I grew up in rural West Virginia in this place where there wasn't a lot of classical music, but there was a lot of music. So my whole family played and sang music. My father was trained as an opera singer, but went on to be a Broadway actor for many years, so he was in the theater. My mother was a songwriter on the side. My grandfather played Appalachian bluegrass. So for me, growing up, my childhood memories are of Appalachian bluegrass and folk music played by ear, and just everyone sang and everyone made music. So we had a piano in the house. I didn't have formal piano lessons for many, many years, but I played. So I don't even remember, my mother says I was 2 years old sitting at the keyboard playing probably some atonal something. So I taught myself to play by ear. My grandmother showed me the staff and the notes on the staff when I was about 6 or 7 years old, but I didn't really start formal lessons until I was 14, actually. Oh, wow. So, and then I found a teacher who truly changed my life. So I know it's an unusual sort of background. I feel like my childhood was very full of music, but not in the way that many people in my in my field, not the same sort of background.
Right. That's wonderful. So at some point you decided that, you know, music was going to be your career. How did that happen?
Honestly, I have no idea. I don't know. And I know a lot of people had a moment where they thought, yes, this is what I want to do. And I think for me, it was just a part of my genetic makeup or something. That sounds dramatic, but honestly, I don't remember thinking that I would do anything else. And when I finally started piano lessons and started to learn to read music, which was an arduous process, and had a teacher who really listened to me, I thought, yes, there was never anything else I wanted to do. So I would say those lessons that began on my 14th birthday with a woman named Jean Defoe in Buchanan, West Virginia. She's just a tremendous human being. I really felt like when she listened to my music, she was hearing me. And that was just addictive to me. Just the idea that somebody can hear beneath the notes. And so I studied with her, you know, for 4 short years, and then it was off to college for, many rigorous years of sort of conservatory style training, right, which of course was very different than what I was used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. How about you as a teacher? How when did you decide that you wanted to teach piano?
I guess that probably happened in my high school days. It must have happened that I admired my teacher so much, and I realized how she was changing lives, and I saw how her students just adored her and the relationship. It must have happened then again. Uh-huh. Maybe I just have a fuzzy memory, but I remember when I was an undergrad and people asked me what I wanted to do after I graduated. I remember saying, well, I have to keep getting degrees so that I can teach at the college level. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how I arrived at that conclusion, and I don't think I realized how difficult, like, you don't just do that. You don't just walk out, you know, put your resume on LinkedIn and say, I'd like to be a college professor. So I don't think I thought about it that deeply. So that's just sort of how it happened.
Wow. Uh-huh. Did you start teaching, you said in high school, or did you start as an undergrad?
I think I was an undergrad. There was a, still is, a wonderful community music program at West Virginia University, uh-huh, and I started teaching in that program, and I never stopped. So I was probably 18 or 19 when I started teaching children in that program, and I've been teaching ever since.
And did that come naturally to you? Was something that, you know, some people love teaching, but sometimes it takes a while to...
Yeah,
understand.
Yeah. I think what came naturally to me is just dealing with human beings. I think I deal with people well. I think things that I struggled with and really had to learn, I teach well because I remember being taught. You know, most pianists don't remember when they first learned to read music, or they don't remember the first songs in their method book or whatever, because I was 14. You know, I teach reading really well, and I teach certain basic skills really well because I had no idea how to do that. So I think I was probably an intuitive teacher, but like many teachers, I would like to go back in time and apologize to all those students because I know so much more now.
Right. Well, it's amazing to hear you say those things because I was also a late starter. I started when I was 12. My first formal lesson was when I was 12. And I tell my pedagogy students exactly the same thing you just said. You know, I remember when I had to learn how to count compound meters, right, and I remember how much it took for me to read bass clef. I could read treble clef very well. So it's just incredible. There's a lot of advantages to starting later when you remember those things.
I think so too. And for me, the biggest advantage is that I trust my ear. I rely on my ear, and I love it when a student comes to me and says, I don't want to learn to read music. Can we just play by ear? And I say, absolutely. And I know how to do that. And I'm not afraid of that because that is the benefit, I think, is when you come to study a little later and you learn to read music later, you've sort of developed two sides of right now what we think of as, you know, good musicianship.
Right. You know. That's wonderful. So then you graduated from the University North Carolina, correct? Greensboro. Mm-hmm. And your first job was?
Let's see. My first job was actually a fellowship at UNC Greensboro. And then I was hired as an adjunct to teach piano and group piano and theory. And I was there for many years. And then I taught at North Carolina A&T State University, which is also in Greensboro.
I see.
And I was there for 4 or 5 years. That was a wonderful job, but it was not a tenure track job. So then I applied for the St. Thomas job in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. So I was curious, we were talking a little bit earlier, and of course your name is very well known in the field as kind of the expert, one of the experts in mindfulness, peak performance anxiety. I was wondering how you gravitated to that particular aspect of piano playing.
Yeah, it's really funny to hear the word expert and mindfulness in the same sentence, because I kind of feel like no one is really an expert in human consciousness. But it's really weird because I never started out to do this work at all. In fact, my passion when I was writing my dissertation was music for social change. I'm really interested in social justice issues. I was kind of obsessed with the idea of taking the Appalachian, you know, folk tunes and protest tunes and people like Frederick Shevsky who weaves them into their piano music. And I really wanted, that was my dissertation, is how music can bring about social change through melody. So that was kind of the path I was on. But then two things happened sort of along that path. One is that I met and married my husband, who's an engineer and a very, very wonderful amateur pianist, one of these award-winning international superstar pianists who really struggles with performance anxiety. And just as I said, I teach well the things I struggle with, I do not teach well the things that come naturally to me. So I am an adrenaline junkie. I love adrenaline. I love, you know, talking in front of people and playing. And so I struggled to help him manage his anxiety. That's the first thing that happened. And the other thing that happened was that my mother passed away in her 50s of cancer. And she had been such an important part of my life. And she was very much into mindfulness, meditation. She was a licensed hypnotherapist. So she worked with people on their anxiety management. So after she passed, one thing I wanted to do to honor her memory is I went to her old university and I got the same certification in hypnotherapy. I thought, I'm going to carry on my mother's tradition. I'm going to help people. And while I was there earning the certificate, I was thinking, oh my gosh, this would be so great for musicians who are struggling with stress. So it was kind of this perfect storm of things that happened at the same time. And that sort of, not sort of, that immediately changed the trajectory of just to everything that I'm doing now, because the hypnotherapy led to the idea of the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. And that led me down to the path of, well, how can cognitive behavioral psychology help us understand what's happening? And then I thought, well, that's not enough, because really it's not just about how you think, it's about how you're perceiving what you're doing. So then I followed the mindfulness path, and so they sort of all came together in this sort of explosion of whatever it is I'm doing now. So.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I can tell you have a very curious mind.
That's
wonderful. Yeah, that's wonderful. So tell me a little bit about, when did all this work started for you? About how long, like 10 years ago or so?
19 years ago, mm-hmm. I would say, mm-hmm. because my mother died in 2004, just 2 months after I graduated with my DMA. And I really think she hung on. She really wanted to see me. Nobody in our family had earned a terminal degree in anything, and she really wanted to see me walk across that stage. And she did, and it was wonderful. And then she passed. And that year, I went and got that certification and just thought, you know, there are many ways to change lives, and we can do it through social justice, and we can do it through protest tunes, and we can also do it by examining the mind and by looking at the internal part of us that performs. Teachers are very good at teaching all the external things, because
right.
that's how we're trained. We're trained to teach technique and ear training and theory and all of those wonderful things, but we're not well trained in how to teach people how to think or how to recognize, you know, healthy or unhealthy thoughts, or how to monitor self-talk, or how to just be still and see what's happening. So that's kind of my current obsession.
So when you work with students, do you incorporate all this knowledge into the lesson, or is this something that you do outside, like in a course or a workshop, or both?
Yeah, I do. If I could teach a course at my university, I would, but we're a liberal arts school with just packed credit load, as many people are struggling with. So we could do an elective course. But what I have done is I embed it into the lesson. I do give some convocation sort of lectures to the student body. But actually, when I was researching for my book, I used my students as my guinea pig. Mm-hmm. So for 3 years, I would assign weekly mental skills activities and assignments. And we would try different things. And then I would ask for their feedback. Or I would look at their answers, or I would see what was happening. And so I threw out a lot of stuff that like sports psychologists may use with their athletes, but they don't seem to apply to musicians. And then I had to sort of tweak some things until I thought, okay, this actually could work for most students. So my poor guinea pig students, that's how I started. And I've continued to do that. So students have their lesson, they have their weekly performance class, they also have a weekly mental skills assignment. It might be writing out a performance script. It might be something else. It might be setting goals. But I just want to teach them that this training the mind is as important as training the physical body. And you've got to, every time you practice the piano, you also have to practice whatever it is you're doing with your mind.
So what are some of the tools that you teach your students? Especially, let's think a little bit about, you know, someone who's starting their undergraduate study. What have you seen the kind of the most successful or more useful, helpful tools?
It's a great question. So I like to think of my work, at least as it is sort of happening right now, somewhere at the intersection of sport psychology, which is a branch of cognitive behavioral psychology, and contemplative practices, which is the mindfulness. And I say that because I think both of those areas have much to offer and they are incomplete. What I've found for undergrad music majors is that the sport psychology practices that, you know, psychologists use with elite athletes, for example, work really well from day one. Wow. So these would be skills like goal setting and systems planning and sort of documenting your practice and self-reflection and examining self-talk and learning to identify deal with irrational thoughts. That works great at the beginning. And then what I've found, and maybe I'm projecting because this is true of me, is that you get to a point in your artistic development where that's great, but there's more. What about this performance anxiety? Where is it coming from? I can't think my way out of this. I can't goal set my way out of these complex feelings that I'm having. And that's where I think mindfulness practices come in. And I don't really mean meditation. I mean the ability to visualize, or the ability to be still and watch the thoughts, or the ability to practice being the person who makes the music, but also stepping back and observing, being the observer of the person who is making the music. Not every student is interested in that path or able to get there, but the ones who are just gobble it up. And I see it, because I would have done that as an undergrad. If somebody wanted to talk about the deepest, deepest, most numinous transpersonal experiences that we have as musicians, you know, a psychology textbook isn't going to answer that question for you. The only thing that's going to answer that question is being still and watching and learning from that.
Right. You know, I wish I had some of this when I was growing up. I'm an anxious performer, and often, you know, you were dismissed by, you know, it's all in your head, don't worry about it. And, you know, this attention to these aspects is wonderful. I think the field has become more aware of this, and I think in part thanks to you and other people who are working on this. What do you see? I'm curious about, you know, you've been teaching pre-COVID and post-COVID, mm-hmm. Has the kind of the map, the anxiety map of the students changed before and after? How do you see our students nowadays?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's difficult because, of course, many studies are, you know, coming out about, you know, what's happening with our students. The skeptical part of me thinks, do we know? I mean, is it too soon to be watching that? You know, here's what I think as truly a non-expert in mental health. When I work with humans who struggle with performance anxiety, it's like peeling the layers of an onion, right? Mm-hmm. First, we say, well, I'm worried about, you know, forgetting my music. And then we dig a little deeper and we realize, well, actually, it's not that. I'm worried that I will disappoint my audience. And then we dig a little deeper and then, well, where did that come from? Well, and then it all boils down to self-worth and the need to be loved and the need to be accepted. And it's just, you know, these wonderful conversations that we have. So what I find pre-COVID is that the anxiety is there. It comes out on stage. It comes out when we're preparing for a recital, but it's coming from so many other places, which is why there's no quick fix for stage fright, right? Okay, so then we have this traumatic global event, and now we are post-COVID, in air quotes, because it's still right, affecting our lives, right? But all what I'm seeing is that is just being magnified. The fact that the anxiety is still there, it's manifesting in different areas of our lives, but now it's just under a magnifying glass because we see it so many other places, and we see it, we see students having panic attacks about, you know, homework assignments and standing in the financial aid line and things like this. So I just feel like we're raw and we're in a place that's a very difficult place to be, but at the same time, the conversation around trauma, anxiety, mental health has just expanded, which I think is good for most of us because we can't pretend anymore. Even in a traditional conservatory setting, we can't pretend it's not there anymore. It is there, and what are we going to do about it? I'm not sure I have the answer to that, but that has been just my observations as sort of a person on the side.
Right. It's interesting because, you know, we're talking about anxiety, but there's this other side of what you do, which is about peak performance and using sports psychology tools to help. I think in some ways they are related, right? Peak
they
performance
are.
And anxiety. Is that the case?
They are, and I this is going to be an oversimplification, but I think musicians are behind athletes significantly. I think elite athletes and their coaches and their sports psychologists have understood for many decades that if you train the mind for peak performance, that helps automatically with the anxiety because you're taking a proactive approach. You're thinking, how do I win? How
right.
do I be the best? How do I get the gold? And you have practiced all of these internal and external things to get there. Okay, what do musicians do? We spend hours and hours training the body in our practice room, and when we feel anxious, first of all, it feels wrong, like I shouldn't be feeling this. This
right.
clearly I'm doing something wrong. And then what we do as musicians, we tend to take a reactive approach. Oh, you have this problem. Let's see how we can help you fix this problem and get over it. And what I tell my students is if you go into a bookstore or search on Amazon for performance anxiety management techniques for top athletes, stage fright for football play, you don't find those books. You don't find Michael Phelps is not writing a book on I was scared and here's how I got over it, because all of the literature is what can I do to be the best? What can I do to put my mind in the game where it needs to be? And I really believe, and again, it's an oversimplification because music and sports aren't the same.
Right.
But if we musicians would take a more proactive approach, if we would help our students and ourselves think differently or pay attention to our mental processes, I don't think performance anxiety would go away, but I think we would know how to proactively sort of deal with it, and it wouldn't be weird. It would be normal, and it would be, you know, that adrenaline when we feel scared, that's the same adrenaline when we're having a peak performance experience. And I tell my students, no world record at the Olympics was ever broken except in front of an audience. Those are when the world records are broken because there's so much adrenaline and
that's
it's
so true.
Funneled in a certain way, right? So why can't musicians take that adrenaline and instead of recognizing it as dread, I'm going to die, why can't we get our mind in a place where we use that as fuel as best we can to have what we would call a peak performance experience?
So interesting. Wow. Yeah, I think it's such a complex thing about musicians and the aspect of anxiety, and as you said, is a very, very complex thing that has many, many, many roots. You think that somehow people in sports perhaps don't invest themselves as much as if I don't do well, I'm not worthy, or the idea of guilt and the idea of is that something that...
I think they...
Why do we musicians feel so caught up in perfectionism?
I know. I would say that athletes, I think, do feel that way maybe even more than us.
Really? Okay.
Because they live in a world with, you know, coaching and mental toughness is a whole chapter in one of my textbooks that I had to read for this certificate. And the idea that when you're an athlete, your body is your tool, right? Often. And so I think they're caught up in it too. I think there are many differences, obviously, but musicians have to be vulnerable.
Right.
I mean, to be a true artist, you can't, I had many conversations with sports psychologists, including my professors, where we would sort of argue and they'd be like, you got to develop mental toughness. And I would say, but from a musician standpoint, that's not quite right. You don't go, I'm going to kill this Bach fugue, right? You go out to the piano, I'm going to show you. No, you do the opposite. You try to open your heart and maybe even set your ego aside and see if this music will come out. And I think that's what's hard for musicians. It's like you open Pandora's box a little bit, but not a whole lot. So it's the question of the century. I don't know if we'll ever be able to answer it, but to me, that's what's fascinating. And to me, that's what the journey is about, is we're such complex beings. What more can we learn? What more can we discover? What even can we develop the vocabulary and the language to talk about the ineffable, which is what we're talking about, basically, what when we're saying, what does it mean to be an artist or a performer or a human, you know?
I'm wondering, you know, you also do presentations for teachers and workshops. You see a lot of interest in teachers in these topics, right?
I do. I see a lot of interest. When I first started doing this work, I saw a lot of interest in the students. The students would line up. If I would visit a university, you know, they'd be lined up outside the auditorium. The teachers, some were interested, some were very skeptical, which surprises me because we all have these issues, right? But now we're at a point where the teachers are just as interested. And I think it's because our conversation around mental health has changed. I think our students are very open with telling us how they feel. And I think it's becoming less of a stigma in our culture. It's not true in other cultures around the world, which is what I'm learning. But in especially, I would say, North America, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, there is, and I think it's because there's a lot of research in the English language and a lot of people are beginning to look at, you know, this. So there is a lot of interest. But if I go other places on the planet, sometimes I feel like I'm stepped back in time in that the professors will say to me, literally, they will say, my students don't have this problem. That's all. That's nice that you're giving this lecture, but my students don't have it. Well, meanwhile, their students are lined up to sit in the auditorium and hear about this because in some cultures and in our culture, too, it's a reflection of our teaching. If my student is scared, I've done something wrong. I've failed them as a teacher, or I haven't picked the right students who are tough enough. You know, it's just, it's so funny to think about how our identity and our ego, it doesn't just affect our performance. It affects how we teach and how we respond to new things and different ways of thinking. But to your original question, there is tremendous interest. I don't think I'll ever be out of a job just because I think anxiety isn't going away and musicians are becoming more aware.
You mentioned language and how the English language is kind of expanding in terms of, you know, using people are using these words that are referred to psychological health more and more often, like self-compassion and things like that. I think that that kind of also shows that there's more of an interest, things that we tended to hide maybe 30 years ago. Now we probably learning to be more vulnerable. And
yeah, that's a great observation. And it's a two-edged sword because you develop this vocabulary. And at the same time, as things become sexy and they hit the media, then words become charged, like wellness and mindfulness and, well-being, you know, spiritual experience. Sometimes we have to develop the language, but then sometimes I find in my work I have to work around the language to avoid sort of biases
cliches and things like that.
But it's an excellent observation.
That's true. So you, we were talking earlier about your research, and one of the things that you did was a Fulbright visit abroad. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. That was my most recent adventure. That was, in fact, I got back in early February. So I left in September of 2022 and got back in February of this year. So that's, I spent one academic semester in Ankara, Turkey, as part of a Fulbright research project, which is I wanted to teach, but I also wanted to see if I were to offer a 9-week sort of performance skills seminar mental skills for peak performance, performance anxiety management. If I were to do something like that, how effective would it be? Kind of already knowing the answer, but you know, research. So
right.
I had done some work in Turkey in 2019 studying just how performance anxiety is perceived among Turkish musicians, and was very, it was very captivating data of how wrenching the anxiety is, because there aren't resources there. There aren't resources in the Turkish language, or people who are doing what I do, or books or websites. So I wanted to follow up that research by teaching at a conservatory and working with students. I think that experience has really changed, or it is changing. I'm still struggling with sort of processing everything, but it's changing my, it's challenging my biases about how we talk about performance anxiety once we're outside of the English-speaking Western world. Because even our tools for measuring anxiety, even our inventories, use words that don't pertain to musicians who play folk instruments or jazz, or they play by ear, or they don't play notated music, or they don't use stage fright. They have different words or different, you know, metaphors. So I'm realizing that our next step, I think, in this field is to be more culturally responsive in how we teach performance anxiety, not just how we measure it, mm-hmm. if you can measure it, but how we work with our international students,
right.
our students who are first and second generation immigrants, our students who are coming from a different part of the United States where the culture is different and the assumptions are different and the biases are different. Because I've always said performance anxiety management is not a one-size-fits-all solution, because everyone's different. But what I now need to do is take a bigger step back and say, understanding performance anxiety and measuring anxiety and looking at anxiety, that's not one size fits all either. And I think it's pretty arrogant for us to assume that we can take a tool and go to any country and translate it and say, here, let's see how anxious you are, or let's see where this is coming from, because the cultures are so different and the views of mental health are so different and the conservatory style teaching is so different too. So I was hoping to simplify my life, but I didn't. I actually made everything harder
and more
complicated.
Well, I mean, coming from a different culture myself, I can really see how, a lot of these, I think, maybe I'm completely wrong here, but I think in terms of psychology and psychological research, a lot of it is very connected to the language and to the culture where it happened. And so seeing it from outside and seeing it in different contexts, I can imagine it have been very kind of eye-opening.
Very eye-opening and very humbling to mm-hmm. realize that an American teacher can't just plop herself down in the middle of another country and say, hey, I've got all these strategies and answers for you.
These solutions.
Right? I have very all the solutions. American. And then I find out, you know, I've made so many mistakes, which have hopefully made me a better person, you mentioned the language. You know, when I was in Turkey in 2019, one of the students in the seminar raised her hand and said, what do you think about, and she said it through a translator, what do you think about people who need medication to handle their anxiety? And I answered that question the way I would answer it if my American students would ask it, because my assumption was this student meant if I go to a doctor and I get diagnosed with this anxiety disorder and I get this prescription, and is that okay? And
right.
I would tell my students here, of course it's okay.
Right.
You have to do what's right for you. You have to follow your doctor's advice. But right after this student asked that question and I started to answer, a teacher stood up because she spoke English and she stopped me and she said, I need you to know what she's asking you is these illegal drugs
that
they trade, they get them from the Russian black market and they trade them amongst themselves. Is that okay? And I'm so grateful that teacher intervened, because my bias could have done a lot of harm if I had said,
sure, go
take all the drugs, nobody cares. And I had to say, no, this is a good thing
to see a doctor.
Exactly. And even that assumption I found out from this Fulbright, you know, there is no campus health center. There's no psychologist on campus.
Right.
There's no like health insurance that covers counseling. It's cost prohibitive. Students can't afford a therapist. So even my advice to them
It's a completely different context.
Completely different.
Yeah, we get so blindfolded of by our our culture where we live, and it's amazing. Well, I think we're coming to the end of the time, but I'm wondering, just a kind of a global question, what aspect, and I know you seem like a person who enjoys doing a lot of different things, like I said at the beginning, very curious mind. Where do you draw inspiration from what you do? What inspires you in your work?
I think what inspires me in my work is watching other people in my field who are changing the world, but in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And for me right now, that means the people in my field who are doing the difficult work of challenging, our social justice issues all over the world, and the people who are doing the DEI work, and the people who are trying to make our world more inclusive and welcoming for all people. And I feel like I do that on a small level when I work with individual groups of students. I try to get into their, world. But I really admire the people who are brave and they're on the vanguard of a very quickly changing world, especially in the arts, because I think the arts often lead global change. And so these are the people who inspire me. And these are the people when I'm really tired and I feel burned out, I think, no, I can do this. Because this person I admire just gave this amazing keynote about this, or they're using this program to bring music to this community. I'm really proud of the people in my field who are making a difference. And I think it's just going to become more and more spectacular.
That's wonderful. There's still hope for us.
There is still hope for us.
That's wonderful. Well, before I let you go, one thing I didn't mention earlier is that Vanessa is a wine specialist and a connoisseur. So here's a question for you.
Okay.
What's the best country for wine? Say Argentina.
I'm going to say the Mendoza region of Argentina is by far the best place you can get Malbec, and I am not swayed at all by your question.
Oh my gosh. Of course, I'm joking.
But it actually would be my favorite place to get Malbec. I think Argentina gives France a run for its money.
Oh my gosh.
It's a different style of Malbec, but it is spectacular.
That's wonderful. Well, I guess we have to go out to dinner and you recommend some wine.
That sounds great.
Well, thank you so much, Vanessa.
Thank
it's
you
been
so
a pleasure.
Much. It's been my pleasure.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Francis Clark Center is a not-for-profit educational organization that serves the advancement of piano teaching, learning, and performing. Divisions include Piano Magazine, Piano Inspires Kids, Journal for Piano Research, National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy, the New School for Music Study, Piano Education Press, International Online Teacher Education, and Piano Inspires Online Community Hub. Please visit us at pianoinspires.com to learn more about our impactful work and inspiring community.